I was looking through my closet this morning, which doesn't take very long. I have two pairs of dress pants and two pairs of blue jeans, and I'm wearing the one pair and because the other pair is in the trunk of the car because I wore it the other day, which is will come later in the story. So anyways, the reason I'm up here is Susan and I are leaving for Israel next Sunday, and we're going with Moody Bible Institute, and some of you might listen to Michael Rydelnik and Michael Van Lanningham. They co-authored the Moody Commentary on the Bible, and Michael Rydelnik has a show on Saturday morning on Moody for 2 hours, and he used to be on Wednesday morning a little bit, but he's really a smart guy. It's like, I have to go, okay, Susan, where is it? You know, and he just knows exactly where everything is in the book. So we're going, I think, with roughly about 80 people. I think some Russ Munson's friends might be going. I'm not sure. But so it'll be an interesting trip. I lived there back in the early 70s for about 9 months on Kibbutz Shar Makim. And Susan and I had the opportunity to go with our children in 1999. And all I got to tell you, it's a really interesting place because this whole book, it just comes alive there. You get to see where it all is. But the people who live there, they just live there. They don't understand that it's like really cool that they live there. They're just there because that's what they do. But I was kind of thinking about one of the highlights of our last trip when we were there in 99. And it has to be the time, it's a very unusual country. But anyways, so we're staying at this beautiful Hyatt Hotel in Jerusalem. And we decide that day we're going to go to see where Jesus was born, in Bethlehem. And Bethlehem is in the West Bank. And in Israel, at least back then, all the taxi cabs were Mercedes-Benz. And they had only the driver and the passenger in the front and three seats in the back. Well, lo, there's five of us, Susan, myself, and three boys. So everywhere we went, we had to take two taxis, which was fine. But anyways, so when you're in Jerusalem, you're sort of like in Oak Brook. It's very corporate, and they got Cisco and Motorola. All the high-tech companies are there. They have offices. It reminds me of Oak Brook. It's very beautiful. As soon as you cross into the West Bank, it's like you just went back 2,000 years. It's kind of rubbly and dusty and certainly not high-tech. And that's just how it is. I just always remember, like, wow, you cross, and it's you've just gone back, you know, 2,000 years. So the day we chose to go was an interesting day because that day was a solar eclipse. And back then, Yasser Arafat, who was the head of the Palestinians back then, decreed that no Palestinian may go out during the solar eclipse because I guess he was afraid they'd go blind or something looking at the sun, which made it great. There was no traffic or anything, you know. It's like, zoom right in, get to the church. And so the first thing we get there and we're parking the taxis and there's just a few other cars there and this young boy comes up to us. He says, I'll watch your taxi for 5 shekels or, you know, whatever the amount of money was. And the cab driver's like, you know what? He says, I'll give you 5 shekels, but I'll watch you because, you know, the taxi won't be here when we get back. So then we go into the temple, and I'm wearing shorts, of course, which is pretty cool. Susan's wearing shorts, of course, which is not pretty cool. And this very old cranky woman started screaming at her, and I'm not sure what language it was, but basically she wanted a few shekels so she could rent her like a shawl to cover her legs, and her legs are much better than my legs. But anyways, we did the leg cover thing. We went in and we saw the place where Jesus was born. I had been there before, but then we would come out, and our kids in Israel, they still have a lot of dietary laws, so they have the milk, the milchik and the fleishich. That's really hard to say for most of you, but it's the milk and the flesh, or the milk and the meat. Never shall they should meet, never. I don't think I was probably 16 years old when I had my first cheeseburger. And you can ask Susan, it's still, I mean, I eat them, but it's sort of like, you know, if you could have it without cheese, it would be better, you know? It's like, I just don't like the cheese and the meat together. Never would I drink a glass of milk with a hamburger. That's like, ugh, you know, that's terrible stuff. So, but anyway, so our kids, you know, in Israel, so they have restaurants that are milk restaurants that are dairy restaurants that don't serve meat, or they have restaurants that serve meat, but they don't serve milk, cheese, et cetera, et cetera. And then they have just regular restaurants. So our kids, well, they were young teenagers at the time, not happy with the food, let me tell you. You know, three young, you know, 14, 13, 14, and 15, whatever their ages were. They're not happy. So we're coming back from the West Bank. We cross through. We pulling up to the Jerusalem Hyatt, beautiful hotel. There's this huge Hasidic wedding. The Hasidics are the very Orthodox Jews with the beards and the hats. And they're having this wedding. But as we're going by, my oldest son sees the Domino's pizza guy. He's driving his scooter, the Domino's pizza scooter. Dad, can we get pizza? You know, we're dying. We can't. We're not eating anything. You know, you're starving us here. I says, well, we'll find out. So I go in and I ask the concierge, I says, can we order some pizza? She's like, sure, you know, and she calls up and she says, well, you'll have to wait down here for them. And they're very quick. They're very close by. Should be like 15 minutes. So Susan and I think the other kids, I'm not sure if you were there exactly what happened, but I was there. I remember that. They might have gone up to the room. The pizzas show up and it's like World War V broke out. I mean, these Hasidic Jews, they are screaming. I can't understand. They're talking way too fast for me. And they were just going on and on. And I'm like, what is going on? They're obviously not happy with me, you know? And I go to the concierge. I go, what's going on? She says, oh, those crazy Jews. She says, they're upset because you're having pepperoni pizza, the meat on the cheese. And you know, they're just going wild about it. I'm like, so what should I do? And she reaches under her podium and she pulls out like a big kind of like Walmart bag or something, shoves the pizzas in the bag. She says, here, just take it and go. Don't worry about them. They're crazy. So that's kind of the pizza story when you go to Israel. You kind of got to be careful. They do have McDonald's. I don't know if they have cheeseburgers at the McDonald's or not, because I wouldn't eat them anyway. So. But anyways, next Sunday, we're going to go with Moody without our children, and it's going to be pretty good. But the other thing that's kind of interesting, when I lived on kibbutz back in the 70s, there was a group of us. We were volunteers, they called us, sort of like an exchange program, except my parents didn't get somebody. You know, they just got rid of me. So it was a good exchange program. But anyways, so over the years, I've lost contact with most of these people, but they had like a reunion a few years ago, and we met up, and everybody got older but me. And so, and anyways, I'm sitting at my desk working on this message like a week ago, and I get this email, and it's like, huh, that's one of the people from the kibbutz, you know? It's like, isn't that weird? And she's writing to tell me that Bernie Sanders, you know him, he's second Democratic guy. But anyways, he was on the same kibbutz as I was, except about 3 or 4 years prior. And I guess when I get news on the Jerusalem Post on my phone, and I've seen some things on Yahoo, everybody's like, oh, Bernie Sanders, that's where he learned to be a socialist, you know, on the kibbutz. That's where he gets these ideas. And I'm like, well, I was on the same kibbutz. I never got any ideas like that. So, but it was just kind of odd how God was working. Just when I'm working on the message, I think I hear from her like twice a year, maybe, that it was at that time. So the name of the kibbutz was Sharm Akim. I think you'll probably see it in the news. I know they're interviewing all kinds of elderly people at the kibbutz to find out if anybody remembers Bernie. And I'm sure people are looking for the good he did and the bad he did as well. So, well, let's talk about Israel for a minute. Israel, about 8,000 square miles. Illinois, about 58,000 square miles. Israel's this little tiny little piece of land. It's very small. So you could fit about 7 Israels into the state of Illinois. Think about that. This is a small country. And probably, I don't know, 35%, 40% of Israel is desert. So there's really not much there. You know, when you're out in the desert, you could drive for a half hour and close your eyes and then open them and you don't think you've gone anywhere because that's just how it is. So it's a tiny sliver of land. And when you compare Israel to its neighboring Arab countries, it's about 1/800 of the size of the Arab land surrounding it. This is a huge difference. I mean, 1/800. And then let's talk about people. The Middle East Arab population, depending who you look at and what countries you include, is about 600 million people. Israel is 6 million people, 6 million Jews, and about 1.5 million Israeli Arabs that live there. So it's about a little over 7.5 million people compared to 600 million neighbors, and most of, not the neighbors themselves, but most of the governments of these neighbors aren't too thrilled with them. They'd rather see them not there. So think about this huge differential in terms of the number of people and population, things like that. So I want to go back to 1948. I promise we'll be out because they have to go to the airport, I think. They're on a plane at 10 o'clock tonight, so we'll be done. So there's a movie, I know Penny's seen it, Against All Odds. Some of you might have seen it. It's about the story of Israel. And I'm just going to recap a couple of three or four quick stories. When Israel declared statehood in 1948 in May, within 2 weeks after they declared statehood, they were attacked by five different countries on six different fronts. And the story goes that U.S. military, West Point, the cadets from West Point, New York, would go to Tel Aviv for lectures for like a month to learn about Israeli tactics and strategies, and because they're pretty good. I mean, they've managed to defend themselves through a whole bunch of conflicts over the years. And this one soldier was like, well, excuse me, so when you were attacked, how big was your army? He says, well, we had 500,000 men, women, and children. We didn't have an army, but we just had immigrants. They just come in, and that's all we had. Well, what was your Air Force like? Oh, well, we had two Cessnas. Oh. and what about your artillery? Well, we had, like, I think it was two pieces of artillery and one tank, something to that effect. And he goes, but when Egypt attacked, Egypt was kind of the main aggressor in 1948, Egypt sent 800 tanks up through the desert in 1948. And plus there was four other countries on five other fronts with regular armies that were armed and trained and equipped. So they don't send people from West Point there anymore because it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't work. How could you possibly 500,000 men, women, and children with no planes, no tanks, no armor, just a hodgepodge of weapons, how could you possibly survive against all these armies? Well, I would say it's that. So, and then there's a story about in the Golan Heights, which is in the north, and I think we're going to be going to Galilee, and I lived in the north when I was there. The Golan Heights is kind of even back in the 70s, it was a dangerous place, because I remember going up there, and our guides, they all had guns when we went up there. But the story goes back in not the War for Independence, I believe it was like the Six-Day War, this platoon of about 10 or 12 guys gets lost and separated up in the Golan Heights. And it's nighttime, they get lost, they're separated, and oops, we're in a minefield. And if you know anything about minefields, you walk very slowly, and you take your bayonet, and you kind of, you know, it could take days to get out of this thing. And in this movie, Against All Odds, they interview both Israelis as well as Arabs, because now a lot of them are, you know, friendly towards each other. But anyways, in this particular case, they interviewed some of the Israelis, and they said, well, how did you get out? He said, this huge wind came along, just blew the sand and the dirt and exposed all the mines, and we just walked out. And they said, well, stuff like this, that doesn't happen. You know, it's not a windy place. It's not like Chicago. So that's the Golan Heights story. And then there's another story about, this was definitely during the Six-Day War, this tank commander gets separated and lost from his unit in the desert. And actually, I was looking on YouTube yesterday. I saw it. I thought it was six tanks. It was only four. There were four Egyptian tanks and this one Israeli tank in the desert. And all of a sudden, they find each other. And they start to engage each other. And they're fighting. And this is in the middle of the night. And finally, at morning, at the crack of dawn, the firing stops. And the Egyptian tank commander, and they interview this man on the video, and they interview the Israeli tank commander. The Egyptian tank commander, with his three other tanks besides himself, gets out with a white flag and surrenders to the Israeli tank. And the Israeli's like, what's going on? You know? And he goes, well, you were fighting so strong, we couldn't possibly win. Where did your other tanks go? And the Israeli's like, there were no other tanks. It was just us. So, another story. There's a story, and we'll be there in Jerusalem when this was during the 1948 War for Independence, they were defending Jerusalem, and I forget the name of the steps. I can't think of it. But anyways, there's this long series of steps, sort of like the Rocky Steps in Philadelphia, I guess. But and there's these four soldiers, Israeli soldiers, young men defending these steps, and all of us, you know, they're there and they're talking, and then all of a sudden there's like 50 or 60 Arabs coming at them, and they're like, we're in trouble here, you know, we're outnumbered a little bit, and we don't even have much ammunition. And they're sort of, before the shooting starts, because they interview these people on the video, they're saying their goodbyes to each other, you know, and it's like, oh, Shlomo, you know, it's been nice to know you, and Yitzchak, you know, and, you know, we're going to go down for a good reason, and, you know, we'll go down fighting, and blah, blah, blah. And they start fighting, and then you hear, when they do the recount, the reenactment of this thing, all of a sudden you hear click, click. You know what I'm talking about. The gun goes empty, you know. And then click, click, the next guy, he doesn't have any ammunition, and these people are still coming up. Third guy, click, click, gun goes empty. The fourth guy's, I've got like three bullets left, and it's like, well, goodbye. And then all of a sudden, this whole, I don't know, 50, 60 Arabs turn around and run away. And nobody can figure out why. Well, they interviewed some of these Arabs to make this documentary, and they said, we saw Abraham. Abraham came above them, and so they just took off and hightailed it out of there. So if you don't believe in miracles, you know, you could argue, well, the wind, you know, you can, there's more stories besides that. But kind of the point here in Deuteronomy, it appears multiple times in the Bible, Deuteronomy 31:8 and Joshua 1:8, as well as Hebrews 13:5 says, I will never leave you nor forsake you. And in Deuteronomy, you know, this is Moses, and they're taking the people into the promised land. I will never leave you nor forsake you. And I've been thinking about that. And in Psalm 23, most of you are familiar with Psalm 23, you know, when you walk through the valley of death, I will be with you. I'm there with you. Doesn't say you won't go through the valley of death. Doesn't say you won't have problems. Doesn't say I'll solve your problems, you know. Oh, you have cancer, boom, and now you're fixed. No, it just says I will be there with you. I will never leave you. I will never forsake you, no matter what you're going through. Whether it's that call at 2 o'clock in the morning, or the cancer, or the loss of the job, or the car accident, or the financial setbacks, whatever it might be, he will never leave you, he will never forsake you. That was his promise in the Old Testament, I believe, to the Hebrews, and I think through Jesus Christ, that is his promise to us now. No matter what happens, he will be there. And I'm reading, actually I finished finally, yay, Matthew. For this trip we had a number of things that we were supposed to read and pray to prepare to go. And I was reading in Matthew, and it's like, wow, in Matthew 2, in Matthew 28:20, I am with you always to the very end of the age. I am always with you. No matter what you're going through, I'll be there. And you know what? People can let you down, your mother, your father, your husband, your wife, your doctor, different people can let you down in so many different ways. And hopefully you have people that stand with you, stand behind you, and don't let you down. But you really can't totally count on any of those people like and you can count on Jesus. So if there's any problems that you think that you have that God can't handle, I would really suggest that you know, put those into his hands and trust in him rather than the doctor or the money or whatever it might be. Which leads me to the story of the long pants, which that's not really what it's about, but the reason I'm wearing my other pair of long, nice pants. So a week ago Thursday, we have some friends, and they've been here to this church, and his niece, whose mother died about 5 years ago, and she's, I don't know, 25, 30 years old. And her mother died about 5 years ago of a cancer-type disease. Her father died about 10 or 15 years ago. She's been through a lot for 25, 30 years old, however old she is. So she was pregnant and she was blessed with a baby. And this baby was born on Thursday up in Lake Forest. Beautiful little baby. And unfortunately, the baby has no brain activity. And so they transferred the baby from there to Lurie Children's Hospital, Northwestern, downtown Chicago. And they were going to do transplants and things. They were willing to do that. But because the baby was, I considered, slightly premature, but I'm not the doctor, they wasn't eligible to harvest the organs from this child. So now they're at Northwestern, and so I get this call from my friend. And they're kind of not my friends, but this family, they're sort of kind of Catholic-y a little bit, not too religious. Could you come and baptize the baby? I'm like, yeah, I probably can do that, you know? I was thinking about little baby Emmy because we were talking about dedication. And so anyways, I go to the hospital, and there's only like 25 family members there, you know? It's kind of a difficult situation. When I used to be a volunteer chaplain at Elmhurst Hospital, the head chaplain there always told me, he says, when you walk in and it's just the patient, you're fine. You can do anything you want. He says, every time you add a family member, it gets extremely more complicated, you know? And I've been with, you know, some big groups. This was the biggest. There's like 25 people. Some flew in from Colorado. Some flew from Florida. They're from all over the country. A lot of familial discord, if you know what I mean. This one doesn't like that one. This one doesn't get along with, you know, typical family stuff. And the baby is beautiful. And I got to hold the baby, you know. I don't know about you. I always like, Yep, 10 fingers, 10 toes. That's the first thing I do. I'm always counting. And the nurses and the people at this hospital are just awesome. They did like a spa day for the baby the day before, and she had her nails done, and she had like a party nail, and she had a pedi, and her hair, she had hair, and it was all fixed up and really nicely dressed. And so the night before, didn't sleep much. So what do you say? What do you say at a situation like this, you know? So I thought about it, and I don't know what I said, to be honest with you. I just said, you know what? I don't know why this happens. I don't have the answers. Baby's 4 days old. They got a whole family waiting for this baby. Has everything, you know. They had a shower the week before. You know, they had everything for this baby. And so anyways, first we dedicated the baby. And I was thinking about, you know, when was that? In November we dedicated Emmy? Yeah. And it's just like, okay, we're going to dedicate this baby first, but they did want the baby baptized. So I baptized the baby, and I mean, I would say probably everybody had tears. I mean, some people were bawling, some people just had tears, including myself. And so we baptized the baby, and then we all leave the room, and they're going to turn off the vent and pull the vent out. And doctor thought the baby would pass in about 5 minutes, and for whatever reason, again, I don't know, it was a couple of hours, and everybody's waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting, and then they came out and they said the baby died. And I'm like, oh boy, so now, well, Mike, you know, sort of like, can you say something else? I'm like, I dedicated, I baptized, now you want like the funeral too? I'm not sure what to say here. I didn't know what to say anyways. So we just prayed with, you know, the family and the baby, and I wasn't sure. I mean, I don't know how I would feel, if I would be angry, you know, yelling at God, why did you do this? It didn't seem to be any of that for these people. I think they really thought that this baby, for the 4 days that the baby lived, had brought this family together, because there have been a lot of disharmony within the family, brought them together. And so that was a good thing. So it was one of the most difficult days I've had in a long, 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 long time. I've been to many hospitals. I've been with people giving birth. I've been with people dying. And this was a tough one, because they had to like turn off the switch and take the thing out, you know. And so it's interesting. The father of the baby, and I've met him before, his name is Wes. He's about slightly shorter than Paul, but he's younger and much better built. You know. Sorry. Oh, Amber's not here, so to filter me. But anyways, turns out, and he's got these tattoos, and I kind of have problems with tattoos, but he's got these tattoos all over him. So what does Wes do? Well, he's a such and such. Well, he was an Army Ranger. Six tours in Afghanistan, this guy. And I'm like, wow. That's... So he's a big, tough, strong guy who's been through a lot. He's bawling, you know, over the loss of his daughter. And he looks at me and he's, you know, we're, you know, I'm just, honestly, I'm just trying to like get out. You know, that's all I want to do. It's like late in the afternoon, everybody's tired and wiped out. I'm not family. I'm just really wanting to leave. And he looks at me and he says, I'm going to choose God. So I'm thinking, you could have choose to be really bitter and upset and angry and all that type of stuff for a long, 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 long time. But he's choosing to go with God, and God's choosing to go with him, because he says, I will never leave you. I will never forsake you. I will be with you to the end of the age, no matter how difficult it is. He didn't bring this baby back to life. He didn't resurrect this child out of the crib or anything. But I will be there with you. And sort of my, after that, my parting words to the family was, you know, it's hard now, but you're all, some of you are going home the same day or the next day, you know, flying back home, and some of you are going to be around. But all this busyness, you know, and they're going to have a, they had a little ceremony yesterday, and, you know, but they're going to go home, the mom and the dad, they're going to go home. They live up in Fox Lake somewhere. And they're going to go week one and week two and week three. And my guess would be, just from knowing them, that this grief is going to overcome them. So I encourage the family. I says, please stay, you know, connected with these couple, you know, in the future, because it's pretty obvious there's a lot of discord going on. And then I encourage them and I says, you know what? Whether they do or they don't, or how much they do, there are going to be times when it won't matter that they called or sent a card or brought something. You need to lean in and you need to depend on Jesus, because at those toughest, darkest times, he will be the one that will be there for you. He will be the one, and he will be there. He promised he'll be there, just like he promised the state of Israel, never leave you nor forsake you. Let's pray. Oh, Father, we come to you this day, and we just thank you for the many blessings that you have for us. We especially thank you for your promise that we can just depend on 100% that you will never leave us, you will never forsake us. I know some of the people in this room and some of the situations they're in and what they're going through and difficult times. Help them to feel your presence, to know you not in their mind, but to know you in their heart, that at those most difficult times you will be there for them. We thank you for this, and we thank you for your willingness to die on the cross, as we'll be commemorating that in several weeks, and then most importantly, the greatest day in history, when you broke the chains of death and rose again on that third day, on that Easter Sunday. We just thank you for this gift, for this miracle, and just bless each person here, bless them as they're going on their way today, and help them to lean into you deeper and deeper, more and more, as we move into the future. Amen.